All right, so I started the recording. I moved the microphone further away from me, so hopefully I won't sound like I'm blasting into fucking people's ears. That was the funny thing. Doing a podcast, we're all worried about you being the new one on the podcast and how your sound was. And I was the one who just, for whatever reason, I moved the microphone close to me for the first time in like a year and a half. And then it wasn't until I heard it like, oh, that's why I don't move it that close to me. See, further away means that there's more of an echo, which is what some people might have complained about. But I'd rather that than it just sound like you're talking through like a fucking megaphone or something.
Right.
Okay, where are we at? We're at the 50-second mark, so in 10 seconds, I'll come up with something. Or not.
You will.
Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast. Usually I would say with Scott and Dan, but once again, we are working without the ever-present safety net of Dan. But we are being joined by Brian, so welcome aboard, Brian.
Thanks. Glad to be back, Scott.
I was just so out of it, I couldn't even come up with a cutesy intro for us. And even though I was going to use and try to incorporate the word feckless somehow, but yeah, it's like, you know, the feckless to my reckless or something. And then, but then I was trying to come up with a word that rhymed with, it was like, what, stunt, punt, then I decided not to bother. Anyway, hey, I got my esoteric rambling out of the way right in the first minute of the podcast. But we are actually here to talk about, first of all, the latest episode of Legion. And since we did talk about it last week quite a bit, we will also be doing our wrap-up coverage of the series finale of The Americans. So for folks who watch both shows, you're in for a special treat. Just sit back and listen to our yapping about both. And if you're just an Americans fan, hang tight. You can skip ahead, check out the chapters. You'll know where to get to The Americans, or listen to us talk about a show you don't watch. You know, whatever floats your boat. I don't know. So, I say, since we know we've got stuff to talk about here, we should just get things started, right?
Let's go.
All right. So first off, let's talk about chapter 17, I believe it is, of Legion. Now, this was I hate using the word interesting, because I think for me, interesting is a euphemism for I'm not really interested at all. But it's the word that comes to mind. It was an interesting episode in both on what it focused on and who it focused on, and also what it didn't focus on and who wasn't in the episode. It almost, to a certain extent, it felt like they were, and they being, you know, the powers that be, Noah Hawley and the folks at Legion, were maybe aware of what the criticisms might be for the season up till this point. And to a certain degree, this episode is kind of like, oh, we're going to try to make up for it a little bit here.
I was, last episode, discussed being a little annoyed that we hadn't got to the body of Farouk. And as this started, I thought, where is this going to go? And my, disappointment we didn't get to the body faded, because they did do some character work in this episode.
Right. See, it's hard for me to fault the episode for that very reason. They spent some time on character work. Now, one can, and I guess we are going to, we can discuss whether we liked the character work or not, or how we felt about it. It's going to be an interesting conversation, I think, or at least I hope. And I just said interesting again. There you go. So the way I look at this episode, I would divide it up into three parts, because it really seems to focus on three, or one could say four, so to speak, characters. But the first one that we spend roughly the first third of the episode with is Melanie. Now, Melanie has really not played much of a part for most of this season. All we've really seen of her is she's basically been getting high in her room with her vaping elephant and whatnot. She's had some kind of oddball conversations sprinkled here and there with Sid and others. And there was a moment where we were inside her head, but it didn't really feel like it was her to begin with. So she's real. And we talked about this last week, how it was kind of a shame, because you're kind of wasting the talent of a Jean Smart, because we know she's a wonderful actress. And this was also a very strong female character from the first season, and it seemed like she'd been not just sidelined, but almost made, you know, what's the word? I don't know, moot or something this season. So this episode kind of really addressed that. We, even going as so far as to, if I'm recalling correctly, we peel back the clock 13 days to almost pretty much from where the season started, and we start filling in all the blanks of what's been going on with her right up until now.
And I think the opening scene where she knocks Clark out goes back 13 hours, unless I misunderstood that, and covers that day as well. And the discussion we had last week carried over, but then we got into a more present and biting Melanie that wasn't exactly chill hookah Melanie as we've seen her be.
Right. Was it 13 hours? I thought it was 13 days. Okay.
I'm not sure everything that happened in 13 hours. Oh. If that was just to pinpoint when she knocked Clark out and to go back to that day.
Oh, okay.
And I wasn't clear on that, especially with the other characters' involvement, because certainly later when we talk about Lenny, that seemed to have carried over to a longer period than 13 hours.
Right. Well, also, I mean, one of the scenes that we see with Melanie is that conversation with Sid. And that conversation with Sid happened in the first episode of the season.
Right.
But now we're just seeing it from a somewhat different perspective. I kind of think they redid the scene. I'd almost want to go back. I think I have all the Legions. I could actually do that. Maybe that'll be a project for the next episode. In more thoughts on last week's episode. I think I'm going to watch the scene from the original premiere and watch it in this episode and see if, as I suspect, they just did the entire scene all over again. I got a feeling they did. I don't think they just took it from that episode or even took different camera angles. I got a feeling it was done done over entirely. That's what I suspect. I could be wrong. It's just my guess.
My sense was that as well, and we obviously did see different angles,
right?
But it seemed at least to me it looked like they had done it for the purpose of this episode.
Yeah, I think when my recollection has it that when we saw that scene the first time, Melanie's performance, I mean Jean Smart's performance as Melanie or Melanie herself, whatever. Seemed a bit more just trippy, high, loosey-goosey. And she seemed to have more of an edge this time.
And definitely, right. Definitely. The word that I thought when I watched the first time was her thoughts seemed to be much more muddled. Mm-hmm. And in this episode, you know, she sort of focused in for some real biting commentary on the nature of love, if you
right,
will.
Right. I was very torn on all the Melanie stuff in this episode, and specifically those first 20 minutes of the episode. Obviously, happy to see them giving her more time and even giving an explanation. And I'm even, because we discussed it in the last podcast, I actually even will go along with the idea, because this whole thing is that she's being used and being screwed with by the Shadow King. In this case, it feels like I should call him the Shadow King instead of Farouk. I don't know I don't know when to call him, which doesn't matter. But it's understandable how the manipulation is happening with the Oliver factor. And that whole business with her looking at herself and suddenly she's the younger version of herself. And then she's laying poolside with Farouk. That was very... I think for me, it really showed how far she had fallen due to how she felt about losing Oliver, because she's not a character in season one that would have been so wrapped up in the vanity of concern of looking older now. But being with Oliver again after 20, I think it's like, it's been like 21 years or something, and maybe because she's been in this hallucinogenic daze from the vaping and whatever, and just Farouk screwing with her made her kind of this overly concerned about that kind of thing, where I think the character we saw last season, clearly that wasn't a thought that was in her head at the time.
I really think the way they portrayed her in this and the loss of Oliver made it much more, even to the point at the scene where she sees him, she is put in blue, he's in red in the frame. Mm-hmm. Later, the Loudermilks talk about being blue and what that means to be blue. They really have dialed up an aspect of her personality that I don't think entirely fits with season one, Melanie. And I felt like especially someone who we saw last season wouldn't necessarily be as insecure about herself. So I felt like some of that stuff was a little too much for my taste.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where I feel like I can go either, I can flip on either side of the fence on that one, but I'm kind of but my genuine opinion is what you just said. It just, but on the other hand, someone who just basically, she's a woman who's been re-traumatized because she'd spent the last 21 years pining for her, what do we call him, husband? Were they married? They were married, right?
You know, I'm not clear on that. I can't say definitively.
I can't remember if they're married.
I have a sense that they aren't.
Yeah, maybe they're
because
not.
Because, he Oliver presents as sort of the perennial playboy.
Yeah, right. So let's say her lover.
Yes.
Even though it's just a goofy phrase. You know, but she had been waiting, for the last 21 years and keeping the hope alive while, focusing her life on the mission and eventually saving the world, whatever. And then all that falls apart. He comes back. She's with him briefly, and then he's taken away again. And I think the trauma of that just broke her. And that's what we've seen that's happened. And so we're not seeing the character we saw in season one. We're seeing what remains of that character. Or the broken version of that character, and how before she was that was what she was all about, trying to help David and get him and recruiting him and whatever. And now she talks about how now she's talking about how she doesn't even trust what's real or not, and maybe there really isn't a world to save. And she's kind of gone off on that sort of plane of thinking, and so. I can understand it. It's different than what we saw last year, but she's in a different place, both literally and figuratively. But here's my problem, my problem with that whole part with Melanie. On one hand, it's good. It's well acted. There are really some really fun moments, not many, but a few. The moment when she's talking with Carrie Loudermilk is kind of fun, because we're also learning something about Carrie that we may not have quite realized before, and we learn more about it later on in the episode. I jokingly call a mutual friend of ours, even though he doesn't, either he's not aware of it or doesn't get it, which is perfect, Drax from the character from Guardians of the Galaxy, because Drax takes everything literally and doesn't get nuance or sarcasm at all. And apparently Carrie Loudermilk doesn't either.
Right, right.
Which is a lovely trait to see. But getting to the point, my problem is this. I can think of like movies or TV shows where you're watching something where say it's a person who's gone insane, and it could be like a marvelous performance, whatever, but maybe I don't want to spend that time with that person because overall it's not very much fun for me.
Yeah. And I thought it was I don't want to say inconsistent, because I do think we have to recognize the Shadow King's power was powerful enough to mess with David. So I don't want to discount that.
Right.
But the sort of line of things that happen with, when she's talking to Sid and said that's how they control us is by their absence. And when she says, what kind of bitches would we be if we stood in their way? The saddest words in the English language are vacant lot. And, and then when Oliver appears to her, she pulls the gun, clearly angry, building up to this. And then immediately sort of, transports to that younger version and goes right back to being insecure. And the Melanie we saw last year, I think what bothers me most is last season was saving David, and they did that. Mm-hmm. This season is really about saving the world, and I can't see a person who was that motivated to save David not being motivated to save the world. Right. And that's sort of the struggle I have with what we see of what's become of Melanie.
Yeah, right. And in a weird way, that's also echoes my issue with the season overall is that there seemed to be more of an immediacy, urgency, racing to do something with trying to save David or trying to whatever with David specifically in the first season. This season is about the world, and it seems like we're eventually going to get to that body. And I guess that'll lead to something. Although that doesn't specifically connect to the saving of the world, actually. But whatever. Anyway. and we'll probably touch on Melanie a bit more as we go further, because, she does reappear at the end of the episode as well. Very strange episode also, I should say. It might be one of the shortest Legion episodes. That ended way less than an hour. I noticed it ended at the 54-minute mark.
I noticed that too, and wondered if it actually was over, and then the credits ran and noticed it was short.
Yeah. So that was another strange choice, but okay. Next one will be like an hour and 40 minutes or something. So then we had the Lenny stuff. what do we say about that? There certainly was a lot going on there. And really dipping a bit more into the background of Lenny's character that we kind of knew to a certain degree. But now we see, kind of get more of a taste of the life she had in the pre-David year, so to speak. And of course, Aubrey Plaza is at the center of it all, which, and she's doing her great work as always. But it was the sprinkling of the flashes and the encounters with the original occupant of the body, or whatever the phrase is, David's sister. I just forgot her name all of a sudden. How did I forget her name?
Amy.
It is Amy. Okay. Wow. Bad Legion podcaster forgetting a character's name like that. That was the stuff that real and the flashes of what stuff to come, whatever, really for me elevated above, oh, she's just going back and enjoying the crazy drug party experiences and screwing other girls and whatever. That really kind of made it something a lot more powerful and significant for me. What were your thoughts while you were watching that part?
Well, the first thing that pops to my mind is I thought, I love the way this show uses music. And, you know, with Melanie, it was the Flaming Lips. Mm-hmm. And then with Lenny, it was MC5, Kick Out the Jams.
Yeah,
you know,
I love that song.
Yeah, and it, which, you know, is sort of the perfect song to set the table with Lenny. Mm-hmm. I really, really liked the Amy stuff, and I liked the interactions, and I particularly liked the scene where Amy just kept asking her, "Are you a good person?" And just kept repeating it and rattled Lenny. And, you know, the question it raised for me is, we've seen a lot of this people in other people's heads to varying degrees. Mm-hmm. Does Amy have a residue of the type of power David has to be this effective inside Lenny's head? Or is Lenny so sort of damaged that's why Amy can rattle her?
I think one can even expound beyond that, because first one has to question the, I hate saying reality with this show, but the reality of whether Amy is appearing or not.
Right.
I mean, because someone like Lenny, who is even before all this stuff happened, or based on her own life and her drugs, and quite frankly, she already has a certain level of mental instability to begin with. Is Amy could just as easily just be a figment of her imagination?
She very well could, or she also could be a talisman of Lenny's conscience that
right.
Lenny now manifests. Her conscience
right.
in Amy.
Exactly. I mean, that's exactly what I was thinking when I said that. But, however, especially with this show, you know, it might not. It could be something more. It could be so many other things. Like what you said, it's never been touched on. But could there be anything going on with Amy? Except there, since Amy and David are not blood relations, I'm kind of guessing against that she has any actual abilities or power herself for that to be the case. Nevertheless, considering how these things are done with the whole machinery and body transferring and transformation, whatever, I mean, who's to say that whatever was left of whatever was Amy, her soul, whatever, isn't adrift? I wondered in a previous podcast, does Amy now appear somewhere on one of those planes where Farouk is, and where we actually can see Oliver talking to Farouk, or where Lenny was? Did she somehow somewhere like that as well, or did she just purely cease to exist? I was so sure we would see her again. I just didn't know how. So I was very happy to see her again. I still just don't know what she is. So,
Well, what confused it for me was when Lenny saw the flashes that led her towards where she ultimately ended up in the episode.
Right.
You know, when the Loudermilks see those flashes, David sort of, that they know David's giving them direction.
Right.
And I think even at one point, David, they briefly see him.
Yes.
You know, in the scenes with Amy and Lenny, David doesn't appear to Lenny. And so if he's not giving her the flashes of what's to come and what she needs to do, and that's coming from Amy, is that Amy being a conduit because of her relationship with David? Is David sending those? I just thought it was interesting that David wasn't appearing to Lenny at all. And right. yet she still saw what she needed to do. And Amy went so far as to say, you're going to do this. You're going to help him.
Right. With that in mind, I would lean towards thinking that Amy is the device that David is using.
And that would be a great reveal.
Because what her ultimate mission is, that's David's plan. That's all David's plan. And what she ends up doing, well, he's the only one capable of pulling off what happens when we get our little Repo Man homage later on in the episode, which I could not believe they did. But then again, after Clockwork Orange, you know, should I be shocked that they do anything? But that, to me, that might make the most sense, that it would be something fueled by David, because to me, if it's purely her conscience eating away at her and this is how it manifests, that's possible. Kind of been done to death. I mean, that's pretty much every TV show you've seen that ever has, you know, someone talk to someone, that's what it is. It's their conscience. And manifesting as either be the person that they killed or the person that they loved or whatever it is. This is a different kind of a show. I'm kind of giving them credit for doing something different. So I kind of think David, and it's also worse if it's David doing it, because it's also a reminder of what's fueling David right now. Because as is mentioned at some point in this episode, in a one-sided conversation kind of thing, actually it's Melanie towards the end of the episode. David's all about revenge right now. And so it doesn't surprise me that he would use the image of his sister to not only get, not just to use Lenny, but also, even if it wasn't quote unquote her fault, she's still the one who still played a major part in the death of his sister and took over her body. So it's kind of a little bit of a form of torture there as well, I think.
I think that's a good call. To say, is it Lenny or David? I tend to lean towards really questioning if it's David, because I wonder if David knows she loves him, and the Amy manifestation outright says to Lenny, you love him. To which Lenny replies, well, what about Miss Perfect? Talking about Sid, obviously.
Right. That's true.
And so, you know, their relationship, I don't know that David, you know, to quote another podcast, you know, maybe this is friend zone material, you know, maybe David has put Lenny in the friend zone. But clearly, when Amy says that to Lenny, whether it's Amy or Lenny that's thinking it or portraying it, it does land with Lenny. And so this show does a great job of making everything opaque. Nothing's clear, but just, you know, made me think about that. And that in particular.
That's a good counter to the David concept idea, because even if he created some sort of Amy construct, you know, to do this, would it have that kind of thought? Because David would not be cognizant of that. David is not. I think David is rather oblivious to anything like that. That's interesting. All right, I take it back. No, I'm just kidding.
I think that's the beauty of this show. I mean, you can look at it and see two completely different things.
Well, I think it's all, and I think conceivably it's also a confluence of things, because the mission is still David. David's still that's all him. The question is the Amy factor, which is interesting. Right. And I do not expect to get an answer. You know, I'm okay with that. I'm kind of hoping she tags along. We see her some more. What the hell? That could be kind of fun.
I'm going to make a bold prediction.
A bold prediction.
I'm going to make a bold prediction. I'm going to say that we are going to learn the fate of Amy, and we'll know if Amy was real or not.
We better, but I wouldn't be surprised. I hope you're right. And I hope she has a mustache. No. Anyway. that prediction went south pretty fast. Yeah, so, but other than that, I kind of enjoyed it. I mean, even when it was getting, even at any point, if it was going on a little longer, getting a little tiresome, there'd be something about it. Maybe it could be the music, could be something else that would kind of re-energize me. And even though it kind of bleeds onto the other third of the episode, I do like her appearing, finding the car, and again the Repo Man zapping of the car with the kink, yeah. with that great Kink song playing of all things, and then her showing up in the desert. And I like her like all of a sudden like walking away, and all of a sudden realizing, oh yeah, this. There's that thing in the backs in the trunk. I gotta get kind of. So I'm kind of excited about that. But you know, that we're slowly getting somewhere. We're eventually getting somewhere.
Yeah, the thing I liked about the episode, you know, I feel like the last 2 weeks that, you know, I'm being critical, and but the thing I did like is that at least in all of these stories, you saw the motivation for what was driving people forward. And they did, even with Melanie, you understand now why she's going to do what she's going to do.
Yes.
You understand what's going to propel Lenny there. And you understand the Loudermilks and why they're doing what they do. So it did give it some forward momentum. I wasn't as disappointed as I thought I would be that we didn't get to the body because of the development of character of all the people in this episode.
Right, right. It grounds them more, which has not been an easy thing to pull off on this series, to like ground characters at all. But I also liked it because as we were talking about previous episodes, how, you know, they'd certainly done that with Sid, and they'd done it to a certain extent, but perhaps not enough, with Batonomy. And this is like the episode, like, okay, now we're going to cover these bases.
And also, I think the way they did it in this episode sort of raised the stakes for all these characters, that in particular, Lenny, you know, thinking Lenny does love David. And then the scene with the Loudermilks where, you know, scientist Carrie tells badass Carrie, you know, I'm going to die someday. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense in this show, unlike other shows, you don't really worry about people because David's so powerful that maybe something can happen to them because David's been pretty adept at protecting everyone. You know, after this episode, I'm not so sure everybody's going to make it out.
Right. Yeah, oh, I agree. I mean, especially if they keep, you know, if they keep leaning in on the direction that David may ultimately go, that to me makes it feel more likely that we may see he won't be able to protect people if he turns out to, if he ends up flipping the switch, so to speak.
Right.
You know, of course, the whole flipping of the switch thing is like, is that something that happens in the far future or does it happen in a week? I don't know. The impression is it happens in the future. But we shall see. Then again, for all of this show may suddenly just fast forward everybody, you know, years into the future. Who the heck knows? So the Loudermilks, as you mentioned. Definitely of the three segments, and based on who the characters were, probably the most fun one to watch. But it's also because we were watching two characters and how they bounce off each other. And the lovely thing about them is that they're so very different. Both, you know, everything from whether it's the actual actors themselves and their acting styles and the way they go about things to the characters and the way they speak and the way they even perceive life and everything. But I think that's what makes it such an odd couple. It makes it so much fun to watch. And that conversation about Carrie Loudermilk's mortality, that's just that whole restaurant conversation is just lovely. It's a nice little scene. It's a nifty piece of writing. It's a fun, you know, reaction acting kind of a thing. I might be one of my highlights of the episode. Could even be my favorite scene. I'm not sure.
It was my favorite scene, and I like the way they structured it. You know, it started with a callback with Badass Carrie saying, "I wonder if they have cream soda."
Yep.
And so it did the callback to when they were, you know, in Division III and in the cafeteria. Mm-hmm. Then the discussion. What I loved about this scene is scientist Carrie, if you will, really. You could see his love and concern for her, and she had a childlike innocence about what he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the way she acted it. I just thought it was it's like trying to explain a complex concept to a child.
Yes.
And the child very sweetly just assumes, you know, the very literal. And I loved him trying to explain metaphors to her. I thought that was great.
When he says, it's like having too much time in your hands, and you see her looking at her hands.
Yes, I love that.
And the whole, I'll stab death two times in the heart before he can reach you. And his reaction to that was like, oh. That was, it's everything about that scene. It just that was like the cherry on the sundae of the episode, quite frankly. I don't really like cherries. Anyway,
now what did you make of the line where he said, you know, someday I'm going to die and you'll be alone like Melanie?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was interesting that he threw Melanie in there. And which to me calls out that everybody there, and we see throughout the episode, everyone saying, are you ready to go back to work? You know, hey, you ready to do something? And to which Melanie, you know, obviously doesn't. But why do you think he threw Melanie in to make his point about the possibility of her being alone?
Well, the thing with it seems like practically everyone at Division III, I mean, outside of one could say like the Sid / David thing, seems to be alone to me. I mean these two, the Loudermilks are, I don't even know what to call them, but the one who seems to be the most morose or sad or just out of it is Melanie right now. And I think he's trying to warn his sister, I guess, sister, right? About, you know, this is the path that can happen if you're left alone. He obviously doesn't want, and that's when he's worrying about Melanie, he's also worrying that could be what happens to her, because she's not exactly Miss Social Skills. I don't know. I'm not sure how she will be able to work and interact with the world without her brother at this point, because she hasn't had to. I mean, now she has, because of the whole their relationship being inverted, whatever. But, you know, this is someone who's still learning how to eat and go to the bathroom, you know.
Right.
And like you said, she is, in many ways, she is very much a child. And I think there's definitely something going on with scientist Carrie, as you say, so people can understand which the difference between Carrie and Carrie. I've noticed he tends to, in more recent episodes, he tends to look quite stricken. So I'm wondering if his health is actually failing. I don't remember if that's been mentioned in an episode that he's sick or not. Have they said he's sick?
No, but what I wondered, as the reason I asked that question is I had two thoughts. And one is, you know, when Melanie talked to her, she said, are you his delusion or is he your delusion? Right. And, you know, between the two of them, obviously he's the one more grounded in reality. She's more the id, the attacking id.
Right.
But the thing that it really caused me to ponder, was when they, you know, when he saw and they saw the flashes, does he know he's going to, did he see something and thinks he's going to die?
Well, if there was going to be one of them who's going to feel potentially at risk, I mean, he's certainly the most fragile among them, you know, which is interesting because, you know, as far as he knows, Tanami's already dead, but everyone has their own unique abilities or whatever, and she's a warrior, so there's not much of a concern for her. Whereas he, you know, what can he? I mean, unless he's got some wacky device up his sleeve, he's kind of, you know, and that's why I've been noticing he's looked more. I mean, I don't know if it's just the actor or if they're making up a certain way, but he's looked somewhat more frail than I remember him looking, and somewhat more like the years are catching up to him or something. And maybe they're trying to say that's a result of the inverse of their relationship. Although I would think that would not be the case. I would think it would be the opposite, since he can spend some time just, you know, not being part of the outside world. I don't know.
Well, I did notice that it seemed the way they shot him and the way they shot, you know, badass Carrie, he looked off kilter the way he was shot in that scene. And, you know, he's the one, if we had a Deadpool, you know, he's the one I think that the seasons has me worried most about.
Right. Well, it's also because, like, season one, you had all these characters who had not just had a definite mission in mind, but they knew and what their objectives were, but they also all had their plans of action and were in control of what they were doing and whatever. Like, the Loudermilks were always working on this, that, or the other thing to work on David and to work on the whole trying to separate them, whatever. You know, Melanie had her mission. You know, even Clark had his mission because he was trying to get David and eventually whatever. This season, they're kind of adrift because it's kind of like they're waiting on David to do something. And they know, and there's this nebulous, we got to get to the body of Farouk before Farouk does. But other than David taking the initiative and popping little thoughts in all their heads, no one's really doing anything about that. They're just there, and people just keep attacking Division 3. So I'm wondering if so with a character like Scientist Carrie, who being a scientist, which means he operates on, you know, in the spheres of logic. And, you know, he was always working on something. And that doesn't seem to be the case now. And I'm wondering if that, in a sense, also has him kind of like in this off-kilter, adrift state, because he's not focused. You know, and they haven't really indicated in any way that he's been trying to do anything to try to reverse the process of what happened between him and his sister. I mean, I don't know if he can, but you'd think that would be something he'd be working on trying to do, or he said he was going to, but there's been no indication that he's been doing that.
Right.
So and I think that might be one of the lost opportunities that they've had this season. And again, they could have squeezed that in instead of some of the more redundant things that they did over the course of the season.
Yeah, the only thing that has really played up his strengths, and I guess we'll see how well he did is the weapon and putting the tracker on the weapon.
Right.
And we'll see if they can track it. I believe it appears from what we've seen before they can. Mm-hmm. Is what he built, obviously I don't believe just a sniper gun that they would need him to build that. There are plenty of weapons in Division III.
Right.
So there must be something special about the weapon if he built it.
Right. Right. Yeah, it has to be. I mean, otherwise it wouldn't be such a big deal.
Right.
So we shall see. We got an episode without the John Hamm thing going on. So I was all right with that. Didn't really need it. However, and a lot of it was through Melanie, it seemed like certain things that had been touched upon with all those little John Hamm narrated moments were certainly incorporated into the episode. You know, like the idea of delusion, which was something they went into, or, you know, and Monica even the stuff with Letty and Amy might be reflective of one of those John Hamm PSA things as well. That's another reason why the episode was less than an hour, I guess. we
didn't have that. I know at the 54-minute mark you were saying, please insert 1 6-minute John Hamm PSA.
Here's a funny thing. I know what I said last time, but right now, would I really mind it? This week, I wouldn't mind it. I'd like, no, I haven't. Well, all right, I like John Hamm. Leave me alone. Anyway, but it was also, again, it was also interesting to get an episode that outside of the little flash of him touching their heads or whatever, pretty much kind of a David-free episode, too.
Yeah.
You know? Although obviously mentioned a number of times, so it's not like we were forgetting about him. But and Sid, other than, I guess we just get her just in the scene with Melanie, which is, you know, just a, whether it be a replay or a do-over of the scene from the first episode of the season, that's pretty much it for Sid, too. But quick wacky question, because it just occurred to me. So, when we see, towards the end, when we see Lenny in the desert, after she leaves the car, she sees something. All those folks sitting there with boxes on their heads? Did you have any thoughts on that, Brian?
I'll tell you. The only thing that came to me was, you know, the group of people, the chattering teeth people from the monk. That they all had in the room. Put away. Mm-hmm. The only other group of people we've really seen are those people, and if that's some manifestation on this plane of people that have been taken over and somehow incorporated, but there were the interesting things in the flashes, like the one flash you see the sniper laying down and someone with crutches that looks like a devil.
The Minotaur. It's the Minotaur. Yes. It's the crippled Minotaur again that we've seen it. That they ended the one episode with. We saw it in Melanie's head when they were trapping her. So there is definitely now, which is weird because that the implication was there was a connection to Melanie. But seeing that creature in the flashes, and there weren't flashes that Melanie was having. That was, I guess it was Lenny's flashes, right?
Yes.
She was seeing herself with the gun, whatever, and the Minotaur behind her. That's one of those, I wonder if we're going to get a real explanation. That, I think we have to some degree, because we've seen that a few times now. And there has to be something to it. I mean, there has to be. I mean, obviously, they talked about madness in a maze, and of course, when you have mazes or labyrinths, that automatically, you know, makes one think of, you know, mythological terms in the Minotaur, in the maze, in the labyrinth, whatever. The fact that it's crippled is interesting. It's kind of not sure where they're going with that. So, yeah, I that was one of the more surreal images. But every time that creature appears on screen, it's automatically a surreal image. So,
right.
I'm hoping we get some screen time and an explanation behind what the heck that is.
Now, that's a PSA we could live with.
Yeah, I mean, maybe less black slimy chickens and more, you know, what the hell is the Minotaur thing? But on crutches. When I saw the guys sitting there, you know, with the boxes on their heads, you know, that my first thought was, what are these? You know, it's almost like, you know, breeding a new bunch of like Fukuyamas, because they, you know, with the basket on his head. I mean, it's just an odd thing. I know it makes no sense, so it doesn't matter.
Well, they could be the Vermilion.
Could be the Vermilion. Maybe they're, you know, because of their fine hairdos and mustaches, they want to keep a box on it. You know, keep the sand out. You know, they're not veins. They're going, oh, just put a crate on our heads. It's fine. Well, I don't really have much else to say about it. I mean, I liked the episode because it was some character development for these at times underused characters. But at the same time, oh, I hope they get up and go in the next episode. I need, you know, just give me a little more forward progression. I'm okay with things moving slowly on any show. I've talked about that a million times. I was talking about it at work today, how I defend shows like that. It's not that the show is moving slow. I just want the story to progress a bit more, because it seems like we're spending a lot of time and it's just to get a body. You know, just get there already, because it's starting to piss me off.
Yeah, I think if they had flipped this episode and the last one,
okay,
that we would feel more satisfied, because with all the action that happened last episode, but it not getting anywhere, we said, look at all they've done, and they've ignored all these characters.
Right.
You know, I think if they'd taken a sidetrack earlier, then done the last week's episode this week, and we know there's a conclusion following it, to me, I think that would be more satisfying, and I wouldn't have been frustrated in the way that we talked about last week about the lack of character development and the lack of forward motion.
Right.
I
agree. It's something that's interesting. It's ever since we've, with Noah Hawley, ever since post Fargo season 2, or post Legion season 1, I guess I should say, between the last season of Fargo and now this, one issue is I kind of wish one could take a look at all the episodes and the stories and have restructured it, because it just the weight always seems off, and you know, the placement of storyline and where it goes doesn't seem to always be ideal, and I think that's been the problem with Legion this season. Again, I really liked the season. I don't think it's as good as season 1, but I'm still enjoying it. But I'm very aware of what you just said. I wouldn't say it's quite as simple as just, you know, shifting the order of the episodes. I think you'd have to like move some storyline pieces here and there, so it's a bit more complicated. But I think it would be I'd feel just a bit, like you were saying, a bit more satisfied or more fulfilled with where we are right now. But I don't know. I can't remember how many more episodes there are right now. I think there's at least 3 more.
I think there are 3 more.
Okay. And you know what? I fully expect one of the next two to be one of those knock it out of the park jaw droppers, because they're kind of due for that right now, and I'm feeling we're gonna get there now. In which case, you know, Legion still might make my top 10. Don't know. Right now, I'm on the fence. I'm on the fence with it right now. So, And one of the reasons I'm on the fence about it is because at the same time I've been watching that, we've been watching some other show. Check out that segue.
And you're talking about The Americans.
Yes, because now I think we've said all we want to say about The Legion. So let's talk about the series finale of The Americans. Let's go. I think that might be a first where someone's child disappeared on the podcast.
Yeah, that was my son. I think he just had a successful Fortnite game.
Okay, so Brian, you and I, we actually spent about 40 odd minutes last week talking about The Americans overall. You know, where the series has gone, our feelings about it, whatever. Now we just got the series finale to chat about. So, what did you think?
I was satisfied. I felt like there were consequences to what had happened that paid off. But the creators didn't play with their characters in a way to pay off what a lot of shows do, and that is have something shocking or something gratuitous. I really enjoyed it. We got resolution for almost all the characters that we cared about, with, you know, a couple of cliffhangers, Renee. But I was really satisfied. The things that I wanted, I got out of it. The heartbreak, you know, and it came out swinging. I mean, the first scene before the title sequence, you know, where being a parent, the idea that I'm going to do this terrible thing, but it really is the best thing to do for my child. Like, it came out swinging, and it didn't use violence. It didn't use shock, but it still had suspense. It still had high stakes. You know, I thought it was understated in the best way, and didn't really fall for the fan theories that were out there. I mean, you and I are on pages where people have, and we've said, here's what we think will happen. I would hazard to guess, you know, very few people guessed what happened in the finale.
Right.
I thought it was wonderful. And that garage scene, I can't think of 10 minutes of time where I was more on edge and sad and heartbroken. Yet, you know, finding myself in that scene, who do I root for here? You know, I Philip talked me back and forth. Then I would be on Stan's side, then I'd be on Philip's side, but I didn't want Stan to shoot Philip. And you know, I thought it was an excellent ending to a fantastic show.
I'm just kidding. Okay. I loved it as well. I hesitate to use the phrase the characters got resolution necessarily. But I'm very pleased with how they handled that, because they would leave things open ended for us to a degree where we could be satisfied that they were ending, but wonder what was going to happen next. And I always think that's a great key for any number of series as they end, where I'm okay with their storyline ending now, but I know that there's I'm wondering about other things. But much like life, you not everything can be tied up into a neat little bow. And then it's for one to decide, like, because we knew, I think everyone watching knew, or I assume everyone watching The American Zoo, this was a show that was not going to give you a happy ending. Nothing about the show has ever indicated that's where they were going. You knew it was kind of, there was going to be something sad. It could be tragic. We, unfortunately, and I was among those people for a little while there, sometimes we fall into the trap of thinking it's necessarily going to be something violent or death, because that's a weird habit that a lot of TV viewers have had for the last 15, 20 years, where that's where we go when a show that deals in violence is coming to an end, to whatever degree, we automatically assume that's what has to happen. Whether it be The Sopranos or The Shield or any number of other shows. And then we extend the shows that don't deal in violence, but then we think it's going to happen on those. Oh, who's going to die on Mad Men? Shut up. Anyway, you know. Or of course, a Breaking Bad, which, you know, they did kill someone. And it's funny, because when you mentioned the scene in the garage scene, which obviously is a fantastic scene, and thinking about 10 minutes where there was, you had both tension and heartbreak at the same time. And the last time I saw something like that, that was this good, and well, I would say it's better, because it's, I love The Americans, but it's not at the class of the show I'm about to mention. I go to Ozymandias, and the entire desert sequence in the beginning of that episode, which just is, you know, it's uninterrupted by commercial or whatever, so it's all one scene. Between the Walt Jesse stuff or the stuff with Hank, whatever. But the stuff with Jesse is what I'm thinking of, because you have the tension and then the heartbreak of him finding out about what really happened to Judy. I always mess up with Jill, Judy. You know the girl.
Yeah.
I always forget. That was the last time I remember seeing that really effect, that was that effective. But getting back to The Americans, what I really loved about it is, for a show that at times could be borderline Byzantine with their plotting and the convolutions and trying to follow, you know, trying to figure out what's just a MacGuffin and what actually means something. And then you realize at a certain point, and I think I realized it more last season, when the season really tended to focus more on the family dynamic, more so than in previous seasons, when you realize that's really what the show has been about, and all the other things, they've been MacGuffins every season. Like this season, the whole plotting, this part, it's all a MacGuffin. It's really about what's been going on, the trials and tribulations between Philip and Elizabeth, and raising their family and whatever, and the way they are now towards him, compared to the way they were back when we saw them in season one. And it's almost like certain characters had the realization, like Elizabeth, for example. I think it took until now for Elizabeth to really realize how much she did care about or love her son, where I don't know if we ever really got that before this. Which, I don't want to spoil it, but reminded me of something that happened on another high-tier show about a character who doesn't seem to realize how much he or she felt about their son until years later. And if you know what the show I'm talking about, I'm not saying because I don't want someone to get mad at me, but it just reminded me of that. That scene in the garage was that's your Emmy scene. That's the scene that actually is the scene that Noah Emmerich should probably submit.
Absolutely.
I mean, obviously Philip is amazing in that scene because he's the one who just comes clean in how it was just it was a job and how. But it's Stan. I mean, the heartbreak is Stan.
Have you ever heard, and I'm going to do a Dan here, but have you ever heard someone say, you fucking piece of shit, in a way that is so angry and so heartbroken as he does in that moment. I mean, it was like you could take when Philip finally confesses and Stan has the gun and says that, like you could submit that and he's on the Emmy list. It was so amazing.
Oh, absolutely. And I love, and correct me if I'm wrong, until they maybe even get in the car, he never puts down his gun, does he? I think he keeps the gun on him the whole time.
He does, because Elizabeth looks back at him as they get into the car, like watching him.
Right.
And it's not, and he stands like a statue until finally he moves and slumps. And then when he goes back to the, you know, to the surveillance house and is watching, and the way he sits down and looks out the window.
Well, yeah, because at that point he's not looking out the window anymore. I mean, there's nothing, because if anything, he's looking at his life right now and trying and what's happened. And
he's looking at an empty building, knowing what he did, and it's all, he's now faking it the way they faked it to him all those years.
Right.
He is now.
Well, he's complicit. He's now become complicit, and he's pretty much almost unwillingly complicit. But I mean, the gamble that Philip takes by thinking that Stan won't do it, we'll let them go. It's just, I mean, there's so much going on in that scene, because you keep thinking, oh, someone could shoot someone here. You know, Elizabeth could do something. Stan might end up doing something. You know, and then at a certain point you realize, no, that's not what the scene's about. No, they're all going to walk out of this garage. It's more devastating than a violent act. What happens in that garage and the after effects, because of what Philip says to Stan just before he gets into the car, where we finally get the Renee comment made, and it's so, you realize, I kept talking about Stan and worrying about what was going to happen to his career once, you know, word got out that his close friend and next door neighbors were Russian spies, and that seems to be less of an issue since he brought it to their attention himself and they didn't even take it seriously, so that's, I guess he will be fine. But I never conceived of the idea that he would have the thought that his wife may or may not be a Russian spy. And what do you do?
Yeah. And the way that scene was done so well, when Philip said it sort of just as a, by the way, you know, you see the care that Philip has for Stan to say that.
Right.
But you also in that moment are like, damn, that's insult to injury to what you've done to this man.
I mean, I guess I could see it that way, or maybe just overall of how Stan has felt about think about what Stan says early on in the scene when he starts recounting, you know, all the lives that have been lost at the hands of, you know, these Russian spies. And despite their denials, I think he knows full well that they are, that they're murderers. That's the one lie they're still trying to perpetuate because of Paige being there. They weren't that bad, but they were.
Right.
We know that they were. I mean, maybe Philip had a conscience about it at times. That's nice. He's still... he still did what you did. But anyway, my point was, so it's less about just what Philip, just what this whole situation has done, what the whole Russian spy thing has done. So not only have they you know, infested his life, and he's been misled, and his best friend, whatever, that this apparatus also, oh, guess what? They also might, they might have just given you your wife. It's that scene when they're, when he's hugging her later on, during the, I think it's during the montage or something, and it's like, and already sitting there watching her sleep. I'm like, going, oh, wow, that's, Stan has been left in such a bad place.
Yeah, I mean, really, the only person, strangely enough, that I think Stan knows, you know, genuinely has affection for him is Henry.
Yeah. Oh, and that's another one. Oh, Henry.
The phone call to Henry is when, as a parent, you know, I got big tears when, and Philip says, you know, you're great, just be you. Right. And in that moment, Elizabeth basically says, do what your dad said, like be you, you're great. And, you know, Paige is so upset she can't even talk to him.
Right.
It's, you know, the heartbreak of him going about his, and I think what makes it even worse is, like, he's like, oh, you're just drunk, I want to go play ping pong. Like, he's just a normal kid. Right. And has no idea, like, his life is just about to be ruined.
Right. Think about it. How great is it that a show, I mean, there's been a weird tradition in television for a number of years now, where there'll be some sort of storyline. It's usually, it could be spy related or action related, whatever. And there's always that one sibling that is kind of forgotten about. I mean, the classic example is Homeland, where he's got the daughter and he's got the son, and we never do anything with the son. The son's kind of forgotten about. Or the show Bloodline, he's got a daughter, he's got a son. Never do anything with the son, he's kind of forgotten about all the time. And now Mad Men was guilty of it for a little bit, but then they kind of try to work on the son a little bit more. But for a while there, it was like, it's the daughter, the son. We don't really care about the son that very much, but it's just the daughter. But I like that on the Americans that, hey, look, we could have said that about Henry for, one could actually have said that about Henry for the last, for the first five seasons. I mean, they did try to use him here and there, but because he was never part of anything, he was still kind of like an outlier there and whatever. I'm very impressed with not only did they utilize his character, but how much of what they went through, especially in the finale, ended up revolving around that character and that situation. That if you, I would not, if I was laying out my thoughts of what the finale would be at the beginning of the season, I don't know if I would have even written Henry's name down anywhere. Because I just would have forgotten about him myself. So I was very impressed by that. I think for me, there's at least, I want to say there's at least three different times during the episode that I did get kind of teary. I mean, I'm an easy crier, so I might not be the best barometer of this sort of thing. Absolutely the phone scene. I won't lie. I got teary during the scene, the garage scene, actually, and the opening scene that you mentioned before. That really got me too.
Yeah, I think although, I mean, it was, you know, if there was an Emmy Award for best use of children in a drama, this show would win it because. I think we talked last week, they really developed Philip and Henry's relationship.
Yes.
In a way that made what happened devastating, that we cared. And they've also, the one really good use of Henry over the years is he has always gravitated towards Stan.
Right.
And when they're out working late, he's over at Stan's eating pizza. And when they come home, he'll be over at Stan's. And, you know, so they paid off Henry in a way that at the beginning of the season, I don't know that anybody would have foreseen.
Right.
And I thought it was great, the scene with Stan and Henry in the stands at the hockey arena. Mm-hmm. And they use no dialogue. You just see it. And you see Stan walk in and look for him, and he bangs on the glass to get Henry's attention, maintaining the false expression, like, hey, you know, hey, look, I'm here. And then they cut to him and Henry just, you know, in that moment, you know, here's the burden they've left on Stan and the burden they've left on Henry. And it just was devastating. And but, you know, super well done. I think when the creators said there won't be a happy ending, everyone assumed it meant violence, death, prison, yeah, whatever. You know, I don't know that anyone, as I said before, would have seen this coming. And in a way, it's even more emotionally devastating that everyone has to live with this.
Right. The interesting thing is when you have a show that deals with characters that whether they're out and out anti-heroes or people who've done things where, you know, crimes, murders, whatever, where you think, oh, eventually there has to be some sort of comeuppance. There has to be some sort of sense of justice or what have you. And people automatically therefore go to, oh, someone has to die. They handle that really, probably most brilliantly on The Shield. And anyone who's seen that show, if they recall how that ends, I won't spoil it for those who haven't. Go see it. Maybe the first great FX show, quite frankly. I would call it an unexpected and brilliant ending to that series. When we get now this series, again, you're dealing with two characters that, although we, to whatever extent we like Philip and Elizabeth, they're our main characters we've been following, but we're also very cognizant that they're spies for a foreign power against our country. We have seen them kill innocent people from time to time. God knows we've seen Elizabeth kill a whole lot of people just this season alone. She's getting her Jack Bauer on, quite frankly. So the fact that they actually do make it back to Russia, but they do it by both abandoning one child and, I guess, essentially being abandoned by their other child, which is the other thing I obviously want to get to. And how significant an impact that has on them, which it might not have if this had happened several years ago. I think the family unit had become more important to both of them. Certainly Elizabeth having more of a realization to her later in her life now, and just dealing with that. So they're not left in a great place. Although I'm guessing it's, you know, now we're just speculating from beyond, you know, after this, I'm guessing Philip may now track down his son there, because his actual son is there. So he will have one family member. Maybe he'll run into Martha at the supermarket or something. Well, I don't know if they're called supermarket. You know, at the one piece of fruit market or something. Okay, so other amazing scene is, now I have loved the use of music on The Americans from day one. There's a couple shows, you know, over the years that, you know, they're take place in the 1980s that do a really great job with the music. Halt and Catch Fire, which was a very little scene show, and I highly recommended it. Guys, I think it's on Netflix. I assume it is. I don't know. It's an AMC show, so I'm assuming it's there. It's finished. It's 5 short seasons. And it gets better from season to season. But again, it takes place during the 80s. So much like The Americans, they are very detail conscious. They are very precise with their choice of music. And I like that both shows, up until this one maybe, tend not to go for the more obvious song choices or the more iconic ones. The Americans pulled something off here. Because first they had that Dire Straits song, Brother in Arms, which is like, okay, I know that song. A lot of people, you know, it's, you know, big album of the year. But then they end the big thing at the end where they pick which might be the most well-known song they've ever used on the show. It might be. With or Without You, the massive U2 hit from, I think, 1987 or so. But the way they used it, the whole train scene, they might have saved their best way of using music for the last or the last scenes of the show, in my opinion. The way they stopped it and then resumed it, that hit me. I don't know if I got teary or not. I can't remember right now. It was late. I think they already got enough tears out of me on the damn show. But especially for someone who knows and loves the song, because, you know, that's when they're, you know, the Border Patrol boards the train, and they're specifically looking for them. And I love how the music stops. And then once it resumes, once they realize that Paige has gotten off the train, and it's right when, you know, Bono's really, like, belting it out. With it's like, oh, jeez! And there's nothing they can do. They can't make a scene. They can't get off the train. There's nothing they can do, and they don't know what just happened or why it happened. And quite frankly, we don't really know. And I like that we don't have to have a whole drawn out page scene where she says that why she can't go with them or whatever. I think it works better this way. It's one of those ambiguous things I really liked about the episode.
I enjoyed it. That, you know, as I've said before, I'm of a certain age. So when Joshua Tree came out, I remember how big an album it was. Oh, yeah. And, you know, U2 suddenly became the biggest band in the world. Mm-hmm. And I like that song. It's not my favorite U2 song,
right,
but I've heard it enough through the years that when I first heard it, I was surprised. And the way they used it hit me more emotionally than I thought it would. And particularly the stop was done so effectively that when it kicked back in, it was just like, wow. Because when they go by, and I think, is it Elizabeth that saw her first?
Yes.
And then Philip starts running back to the windows. At first, I was like, who is that? What's happening? It confused me for a minute. And then I was like, oh, my God. Like, it's Paige. And I thought it was well done. And the brief ending they give her walking into the empty apartment where they always met Claudia. It was wonderful, because now, you know, after a lot of shows end, you can continue thinking and wondering about what's going to happen to the people. Where are they going to go? And you can say, is that Paige's allegiance to Claudia and being upset at her parents, and or is it that's the only place she has to go and she wants to look after her brother?
I thought about that while it was happening. I realized there isn't anywhere else for her to go, because she can't go back to her apartment, because at this point she knows the FBI is probably all over that, and she can't go back to the house because she knows the FBI. This is a location that she doesn't believe she's assuming or guessing correctly. They're not aware of as of yet. So it's for her. It's at least in the moment, it's her only safe house right now. Just interesting that the place that is her only safe house was the place where she was being indoctrinated and learning so much about the thing. It wasn't until she does that I realized she had to do that. For this show to end the way it needs to end, they have to lose both their kids. It can't be them and Paige. Because then, I mean, the Henry thing is sad, but it's not sad enough, if you know what I mean. It's not,
well. At least Henry has somebody that they trust to look after him. when they rode off into the distance, they had no idea what was going to happen to Paige.
Right. Well, now, I mean, because at least with Paige's situation, outside of Stan, who's obviously keeping mum about a few things, there is no indication that anyone would be aware that Paige was part of this. So Paige could be just as much in the dark as Henry was. So at least Henry still will have a family member in his life outside of, you know, Stan being like a surrogate father for him. So it's actually a positive for Henry, at least. And Paige could also tell him more about the situation over time too, if she chooses to.
And the good news for Paige as well is by not saying goodbye to Henry, if they were listening to the phone, she's not on the phone call to Henry at the school.
Right. Because no one, in fact, at this point, no one actually knows that she even left with them outside right. of Stan. And, you know, again, Stan, can't say no. There's no sketch of her. I was like, hey, finally a sketch of them where they're not wearing crazy wigs and stuff. It's the Oleg thing is really tragic. I was trying to conceive of a way that he would ever be released. And every time I came up with an idea, part of me was like, yeah, but that might not actually work. So, I mean, again, it's possible there may be some way. Another thing I really liked also, and it connects to the Oleg thing, so that's why I'm bringing it up. We don't need to get any more about the whole plot to the coup for Gorbachev or all that stuff in this, because, well, we already know what happens. We already know none of that happens. So clearly, whatever, you know, and the fact is the message got back to Russia by the Jennings showing up in Russia. So it didn't matter that, you know, so Stan didn't have to actually pass the message on himself or whatever. You know, them going there delivered the message. Just because the moment when you see his father going to tell his wife and child, and she didn't want him to go in the first place, I was like, oh, God damn it. That was pretty bad.
And the irony of it is Oleg was always more honest to Stan than the Jennings ever were.
Yep.
And yet, because of the circumstance, he's going to be the one that pays the price and they get away.
Right. Yeah. I kept trying to think, like, does anyone really get like a remotely positive? It's like, not really. I mean, I think what it is, like, all these people's lives have changed dramatically and they're in a sad state. And it's up to them and each person to rebuild, you know? Whether it be, you know, Henry dealing with the truth about his parents and how he lives with that and grows up. You know, Paige now, does Paige just shed everything that she had been learning through Claudia and them? Does she now believe that that's all, that was all a lie? Or not? We don't really know for sure. We don't. You know, I don't think she's going to go get her job at the State Department anymore, but I don't know. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen with her, but I like that, you know. And how Philip and Elizabeth really, how do they acclimate to living, you know, somewhere that they haven't been since they were, you know, teenagers, I guess. And the fact of what we know is about to happen in that part of the world is interesting. Because, you know, the wall is going to come down shortly. We are going to see, you know, little bits of capitalism start to weed their way into Russia, at least at that point in time. You know, there is going to be fast food restaurants in Russia. That's why it's funny the way they stop at a McDonald's in this episode. It's like, I seem to remember when I was a kid, there was a big deal about a McDonald's opening up in Moscow or something. I wonder if that's kind of like a little hint about that.
Philip's the manager of the first McDonald's in Russia. That's the.
No, I thought he was going to be a Cinnabon. No, wait, wrong show.
you know, go on. In us talking about that, it it raises sort of an interesting point that I thought about and I'd forgotten about till we talked about it, is in the car ride to where they pull over and they did the exchange. Obviously, Elizabeth made some enemies by not doing the job and then killing Tatiana. I kept telling myself, like, they're not going to do anything at the last minute. But were you worried for their safety in the car ride?
A little bit. I wasn't sure because they were really taking their time with that. And I actually, there was a moment, I mean, I knew they were going to go to this extreme no matter what. But I did have like a Bonnie and Clyde thought. I mean, again, I don't think they would do that, but I kept thinking, oh, wouldn't it be horrible if they made their way all the way back and they finally got back to Russia or whatever, and that's where something horrible happens to them, because the people that they double-crossed are still technically in various seats of power there, you know? It's not like they didn't just all disappear.
That's what I worried about was... Once they got back to Russia, who would be the people helping them, because their contacts, they'd burned in America. And so, and obviously, you can't tie every thread. But like I said, the way the episode went, I was very pleased. And I was only about half worried. But until it cut to black, I was like, okay, they're okay. But I was a little worried, because of the way Claudia and Elizabeth had split up, and word had not gotten back at that point to Russia about, you know, what was happening, that Claudia and her group and within the KGB were trying to do. And so I was a little worried, but I thought it was, you know, and the fact that it didn't happen made it better. As I said earlier, I just thought it was fantastic. The episode was great. When it was over and I went to bed, I went straight to sleep. You know, I was satisfied. I didn't sit up and fret and worry. I had to process a little bit the emotion, but I didn't think, damn, like, you know, I'm disappointed, or why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do that? I was satisfied.
Well, actually, my favorite part was the post-credit scene, so you might have missed that. So at the very end, Frank Langella does show up, and I'm like, yay, that's Frank Langella! Didn't someone tell me he was dead?
Oh, so you're saying you watched Marvel's The Americans?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. I didn't see Stan Lee in this episode.
In Infinity Cold War. So, also love that, of course, in an episode that was very streamlined, it's basically, the episode is Philip and Elizabeth need to get out of Dodge. That's it. That's your episode. It's all about, we got to get out of here. And what that means. I was very pleased that we had to have one more last round of wigs.
Yeah.
And I will agree. I thought Philip's wig and makeup was very well done. It was like, well, he was able to age himself up or whatever. Elizabeth's wig, not one of her better ones. Because sometimes she's done things where it's like, oh, I can believe that's her hair. This would be one of those, like, yeah, that does not look remotely. Like, it even belongs. How did that Border Patrol guy not recognize you? Anyway. And Paige, well, I don't know.
I thought Elizabeth was the worst, and interestingly enough, in the scene, when she hands her credentials to the Border Patrol officer, she stares right at him confidently the entire time. In a way, more so than Philip did, which I think, you know, is just one last, I guess, testament to Elizabeth's. You know, when Elizabeth gets something in her head, she's 100%.
Oh yeah. She's got a steel spine, more so than Philip ever had.
Absolutely.
But that was their last piece of powerful tension, because I will confess I was worried something was going to happen right there, because we got the picture of her right there. Come on, come on. I could see not recognizing Philip, but come on.
Well, in his defense, the Border Patrol officer paused longer on her.
Right, and he is Canadian, I'm assuming. So there's that. But otherwise, yeah. I was very pleased with it. I gotta say, FX with their upper tier quality shows over the last 15 years, they have done a really nice job with finales. The Shield had a great finale. Justified had a great finale. This was a great finale. I can't say I'm disappointed because someone didn't get killed, because I felt it was just more powerful than that and more important than that. So, well done. Really well done.
Yeah, well done. Now I have one final question.
All right. We almost made my prediction. Damn it. Okay, go on.
Do Philip and Elizabeth stay together?
Yes.
I think so, too.
And the fact that she had that dream that took her all the way back to when she was still seeing that guy and was his name Gregory? I don't think that was any indicator of a situation with their marriage right now. I think their shared experience, I don't even know how well they would even relate to anyone else there right now, quite frankly. And what they've gone through, and these are two characters who fell in love with each other over the years, as opposed to, you know, early on. I think I'll see them on talk show. Oh wait, no, that's the actual actors. No, never mind. So, and again, that's actually one of. I mean, I know it shouldn't be a factor in the show, but one of the things I do love about the whole thing is that the fact that these two are an actual couple, which makes their work together really that much more significant. So, to me,
yeah. Matthew Rhys sent a tweet, and at the tweet it said at the bottom, Carrie and Matthew. I don't think Carrie Russell is on Twitter, but Matthew Rhys is. And after or right before the show, he put out a tweet, and at the bottom, thanking the fans and everything, and said Carrie and Matthew. And I think their chemistry obviously is good, but the way they were able to portray the tension and the strain on their relationship has been outstanding.
Oh yeah, to go to another classic TV show, it kind of reminds me of when the season of The Sopranos, where a lot of it was about how Carmela and Tony are falling apart more and more until they finally have it out with each other, and we kind of got that this season with Philip and Elizabeth, except their having it out with each other happened earlier on, and it was almost like them finding their way back, and
right.
and rebuilding to the finale, where just great. You know, this is going to be the season they get nominated for sure. I'm curious to see how the rest of TV plays out, because I wonder if the Americans could actually have a shot at the big award. That would be nice.
As I think of prestige drama, I mean, this may be the year that it all lines up for them, and well, it should.
A lot of times, being something of an award, I don't want to say expert, I can't think of the word, fanatic. No, not, anyway, who cares? There is a tendency that sometimes the highly critically praised shows, sometimes they wait till their final season to give them an award. Happened Friday Night Lights, for example. You know, they got some awards their final season, like Kyle Chandler, whatever. I kind of think there may be a path to the show to pull it off. There is no Game of Thrones that'll qualify for the Emmys this coming when the nominations come through. Better Call Saul isn't coming back till September. I mean, not that I'm going to say it was an odds-on favorite anyway, but it's usually a contender. But now that they're not in the playing field, they're not in the playing field either. You know, I mean, God damn it! If This Is Us just wins over this,
That'd be a travesty.
Yeah, but I could almost see that happening. But that anyway. I don't want to go any longer because I said we could knock this out in an hour and a half, and we're just a little bit over.
But you discounted one thing, Scott.
Yes.
That if there was ever a year a Russian might win an award, it would be now.
Okay, you know, I do have to go one more minute further on the show, though. Give them credit. Give the creators credit for impressively resisting any obvious potential opportunity they had here to even come up with the slyest of references to what's going on in modern day Russia, et cetera, et cetera. I'm very impressed that they were able to say, no, we're not going to do that. Because they could have. And they didn't.
They were true to the time and true to the characters and, you know, and that's what made it great.
Yeah, they didn't. And also, once you get to the finale and everything that's going on here, this is not the place for a sly wink.
No.
In fact, this season didn't feel like the place for a sly. Other seasons, maybe. This is not the one. You know, the cutest thing should be seeing what the movie posters were in a movie theater. But other than that, you know, this isn't. Oh, and Stan bringing up his son too. Anyway, stop talking about the Americans. Gotta move on. Alrighty. So, to you guys out there, if you enjoyed this podcast, you'll probably enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. You can find the page, like the page, and join the conversation about shows like Legion, like The Americans, and so many others. You can also find us on iTunes the very same way. Type in the Serious TV Drama Podcast, subscribe to the feed, and you can rate and review us there. Unless you didn't like us, then, you know, then don't. And you can also find us in Google a million other ways. I don't know. It would be nice if we actually... I remember we used to actually break 3 figures on our downloads all the time. Now it's like... I'm whining. And finally, you can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @STVDPodcast. It's STVD as in Serious TV Drama. So, Brian, thank you for joining me once again.
I enjoyed it greatly.
Dan was going to join us for, I think this is podcast number 2. Is this 210? Did we hit 210? I think this is 210. I don't have Jason Jones here to remind me what number podcast is, but I think it's 210. I'd only finished watching Legion literally a half an hour before we started podcasting. Dan hadn't actually even finished the episode himself, so most likely Dan will rejoin the podcast, and we might make it a little bit of a threesome here. Creepy. Next week we'll see. Hey Brian, I just like having you here because, you know, it takes a little bit of the load off of me, so thank you for that.
Well, I enjoy it. It's a lot of fun to talk about people who enjoy, you know, quality television and have interesting opinions, and I enjoy it. I do apologize that I haven't raised the Q rating of your show high enough, but I'm doing all I can.
You know what? We can get the cast of some of these shows on our damn podcast. Although how that would ever happen if they ever actually listened to them, like no. And we probably only get like 5 more listeners. But hey, you know what? We're a hearty little bunch. I like that. So it is what it is. All right. It's late. Let's wrap this up. So thank you, Brian, and thank you guys for listening. And until next time, everyone, have a good night.
Good night.